Call the Civil Law Committee to order. There is quorum present. Members, we have one bill on the agenda today. There will be some testimony on it. Members, the intent of the chair would be, and to the audience, vet and have a full discussion on this bill, but we will hold it over and not be taking a vote on it today. Representative Druskowski, you want to move your House file?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 564.
Representative Druskowski moves House File 564 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee would be the motion. Representative Druskowski, you may proceed, and you have witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do, and I've got a delete all amendment 2 to bring it in the form it needs to be, Mr. Chair.
Let's do that. Okay. Everyone should have copies of the DE1 amendment. The chair will move the DE1 amendment. All those, any discussion? All those in favor of the DE1 amendment to House File 564, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape the author intends it to be. And do you know, Representative Druskowski, if others have gotten copies of that amendment?
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding that the amendment was distributed electronically about 9:30 or so this morning.
Okay. Representative Druskowski, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you actually aims to bring the tort liability limits for non-governmental ambulance services in line with those that are government-run ambulance services. In Minnesota, as you know, we have both types of ambulance services. The non-government ambulance services are generally, I think almost exclusively nonprofit in their design, I know we've got a lot of them in the rural part of Minnesota that are struggling right now. And as we look at trying to preserve businesses in Minnesota and creating a more business-friendly environment, and trying to find ways to allow our local units of government and their affiliated partners, in this case, nonprofit ambulance providers, to remain in those communities and serve the needs, the ambulance and medical needs of our folks in our communities. This will help them remove some of their or lower some of their expenses to an extent that will help them better cash flow those services and stay within the service of those communities and the people in those communities for a longer time, so that we don't get to the point where some of these, or maybe potentially many of these, nonprofit ambulance services would disappear, and then it would become again the requirement for government to move in and fill that void that's created by these nonprofits not being there. So this is intended to give them more flexibility in their fiscal operation and bring them, as I understand it, perfectly in line with the government-run ambulance services. In Minnesota, the limit on the government-run ambulance services is a $1.5 million limit total, and I believe it's $500,000 per occurrence. This would bring non-governmental services perfectly in line in terms of the extent and exclusively the extent of their tort liability in Chapter 466 in line with those of the government-run services. That's all I have to present at this point, Mr. Chair. We have one testifier in favor of the bill, Mr. Reinert from Lakes Region EMS.
Very good. Let's have Mr. Reinert present to the committee, and then we'll ask open up for questions after that. Mr. Reinert, if you can identify yourself from for the tape record, welcome to our committee. You may proceed.
Thank you for having me. My name is Aaron Reinert.
I'm the executive director for Lakes Region EMS. We serve Chisago County, parts of Pine County, and parts of Isanti County. We're a rural ambulance service that is a not-for-profit that is solely funded by the revenue we receive from the patients that we transport. And I wanted to come here today to share with you three key points of why this legislation and this change is so important, not only for the ambulance service that I'm responsible for leading, but for the ambulance services all across the state of Minnesota. As the representative mentioned, most ambulance services in the state of Minnesota are not governmental ambulance services. I think that's an assumption that many of us make, is that the ambulances are primarily run by government agencies. And in Minnesota's case, that is incorrect. Most ambulance services, like mine, are not-for-profits or hospital-based, and their hospital is a not-for-profit organization. The vast majority are not-for-profits. The three key issues of why this change is so important to the ambulance services in the state of Minnesota are, one, our viability, our ability to continue to operate today, tomorrow, and into the future. And I'll expand on that in a little bit. Number two, so that we're all treated equally under the law, and I'll provide you some reasons why that is so critical for us for things like disaster response, pandemics, and other issues. And then three, innovation. Emergency medical care, such as healthcare, continues to change, and that change requires new innovation. And that new innovation at times takes courage and the ability to be able to make those changes in an ever-changing environment. So I just wanted to briefly expand on these three key points, and with the consent of the chair, be able to answer any questions that any representatives might have. But survivability. Ambulance services are primarily funded through Medicare. In 2004, the federal government's Government Accountability Office found that ambulance services across the nation were funded 6% under our costs. That was 2004. So if any of us think back to what the cost of fuel was in our own personal vehicles back in 2004 and what they were today, clearly understand how much costs have increased. So if we were underfunded for reimbursement back in 2004, what must that look like today? So expenses are absolutely critical for us, being able to maintain our expenses, being able to manage them and lower them. When the St. Paul companies got out of insuring ambulance services in the state of Minnesota, many ambulance services saw the cost of their insurance, medical malpractice, professional liability, go anywhere from 30 to 60% up. There are very few companies left that provide that kind of coverage to ambulance services, especially small rural ambulance services that have a very low call volume, have volunteers, and respond to any number of different kind of emergencies. So my second point was equal under the law. 144E requires all ambulance services in the state of Minnesota respond to every request for service regardless of any of the circumstances. So if my ambulance service is asked to provide what we call mutual aid, such as we did with the Hugo tornado back in 2008, we may be responding into a governmental ambulance services area. If something was to happen, we now run the risk of being sued potentially in that governmental ambulance services area where the governmental provider may not, if the litigation was such that the plaintiff's attorney felt that it wasn't worth, because of the tort caps, to sue the one, they certainly could sue the other. So that really raises a question. As a leader of an ambulance service, I have to ask myself, can I jeopardize the 450 square miles I serve, the 51,000 people, to go into somebody else's area to help out? I absolutely positively need to go into that other person's area to help out. But the question that I have to ask myself every day is, does that jeopardize the other 50,000 people that I serve? And operationally, it raises questions for us today as an ambulance service where patients may or may not always tell us correct information. They may have done things that caused them to call 911 that we then respond to provide them service. And then based on the information we're presented, based on good faith, we make decisions and then subsequently find out that information's correct. Now we have that liability of that information that we were given that we acted on. And then lastly, just to wrap up, is the question of innovation. I think all of us are aware of how rapidly healthcare is changing within what we call the pre-hospital environment, the ambulance environment. It's changed drastically. We used to be more of a transportation model, where if you called us, we would transport you to a hospital. Today, the hospital arrives at the patient's side when the ambulance gets there. Many of the same treatments and procedures that are done in the hospital are done by our ambulance crew in a ditch, wedged next to the toilet, on top of buildings, in ditches, and everywhere else. We don't have the luxury of calling in a specialist. So my paramedics and EMTs do everything you can imagine, from delivering babies to car accidents to cardiac arrest to chest pain, everything in between. That's the level of knowledge and expertise they have, and they have to do it in any environment you can imagine. Raining, snowing, hot, cold, light, dark, everything else. So with that comes these innovations. And again, I'll be very honest with you to say, as a leader of an ambulance service, it becomes a question of, at times, fear. If we innovate, if we adopt a new treatment or procedure that's been tested, that's been validated, that's been researched, if we're the first to do it, what risk do we run? Would we be safer to not innovate because of potential litigation than we would to innovate? It's a question that, as a leader of an ambulance service, I don't want to have to ask. But in the environment that we're in today, I have to ask that again to ensure that we can continue to serve that area that we're responsible to serve. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We've got some questions. Representative Simon and then Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reiner, thanks a lot for coming. I first have to ask, are you related to Roger Wright?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, I am.
Mr. Chair, may I ask how you're related to now Senator, former Representative?
Objection, relevance.
Older brother. Okay. He is my older brother.
Okay. Well, welcome. Welcome anyway.
Yeah. So then I get to ask a question. Are you from the Dawson area originally?
I am. I'm born and raised, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yep. Very good.
And if it is relevant, I have many stories that I could share about Senator Reiner.
Well, Mr. Reiner, we'll take that offline.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, thanks for coming, and thanks for the work that you do. Obviously, we hope we never have to, but we know it's comforting to know that people like you are there, so I appreciate that. Thanks for your work. Can I ask, just in your specific situation with your company, have you been sued? And if so, how many times and how recently?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have been sued, to the best of my recollection, three times since 2004, since I've assumed that role.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reiner, and to the extent you can tell us, what happened? Were these settlements? Were they thrown out before? Were they jury verdicts?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, in all three cases, we were successful in being removed from the litigation. We were sued along with other healthcare providers. Even though we prevailed from our standpoint in all three of the cases, all three of the cases cost our organization an enormous amount of money. The first case in 2004 cost us $50,000 alone just to go through the deposition portion of the litigation. We were removed from the litigation to the point of at the deposition phase. So even though we were successful from our perspective in those cases, it still cost us an enormous amount of money. For my organization, $50,000 out of a $2 million budget is one half of an ambulance crew for a whole year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Reiner, but isn't it true, though, that your company and other companies similarly situated, you're insured for this purpose, right? I mean, you carry insurance that guards you against the risk that you'll be sued, and so your expenses are really the insurance expenses. Am I right? You're not paying for the legal fees, you know, directly. You're paying for the insurance, and the insurance company is indemnifying you or defending you. Is that
Mr. Chairman, Representative? Yes and no. The $50,000 that I mentioned were the costs that we incurred just in our organization ourselves, of the staff dollars, the research, the personnel that were on the particular call coming in, their overtime costs, those kinds of things. So insurance covered our legal fees, but that number I provided for you was what we incurred as an organization complying to the case, gathering the documents, salary dollars, et cetera.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Simon, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Reiner. So, as I understand it, three times since 2004 you've been sued. You were basically you were dismissed as a defendant from all three cases before it got to any kind of trial or settlement. You incurred some costs apart from legal fees. Legal fees, obviously, covered by the insurance company. In that time, have your insurance premiums gone up?
Mr. Reiner? Representative, yes, they have.
And can you, if you know or care to share that, could you tell us by what percentage or what by what amount they've gone up since 2004?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think roughly, and I'd be happy to find that exact figure out, I think roughly they've gone up by at least 15%.
Mr. Chair, just about, so over that, Simon. Between then and now, 15% or 15% annually?
15% between then, the 2004 case, and now.
Thanks.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to talk to your insurance company because I look at my home insurance and I think they go up 15% per year. But
it really does hinge on who's getting insured.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Can it's you sock all risk please? Related, Representative.
I appreciate you putting a sock in my neighbor here. My question first for Mr. Reiner. Again, I'd echo. I appreciate the service and the work that you do. I've never had to be in one, but I suspect eventually I will. So I want good people on the line there. Can you give some examples of the innovation that, say, a government service has been able to achieve free from the restrictions that you are related to the caps, because they benefit from those, that you otherwise would have been able to do, but these government services were able to achieve these innovations? Do you have some examples of those?
Mr. Reiner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one point of clarification, that 15% increase that I mentioned was in addition to the increases that we saw in general. So our insurance has grown every year about 10% based on vehicles and those things. So innovation, great question, and I appreciate you asking it. One of the things that has become commonplace within emergency medical services that I think first was able to be provided to patients in a governmental setting because of the TORC cap, and was later only after it was tested and found to be comfortable, was adopted by non-governmentals. And that's where we encounter a patient in cardiac arrest. So the patient is not breathing and does not have a pulse. Ambulance services today have, especially our advanced life support ambulance services, have all of the same treatments and procedures that they have in the hospital. So typically, an ambulance service would perform CPR, do those treatments and procedures, and then subsequently transport the patient to the hospital, where they would validate the things that the ambulance service did, and then pronounce the patient. The end result to the patient was many additional charges that honestly were not necessary. So they incur now ER charges, physician charges, etc. Non-governmental ambulance services like my own were very hesitant to provide that service for the risk of the litigation, the risk of having to prove that we were doing those things that were recommended by the American Heart Association, that were studied in depth by the American Heart Association. So only after there was a comfort that could be done and we would have minimal risk to litigation were we able to do that. So subsequently, patients were being transported to hospitals, incurring many additional costs that were, from peer-reviewed research, were clearly not necessary.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Reiner. Then which governmental service pioneered that example you gave?
Mr. Chair, Representative, much of that happened on the East and West Coasts. I'm not sure of the exact ambulance service, but ambulance services such as Miami Fire, San Francisco, and others were first and foremost in many of those American Heart Association activities.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Wright, can you think of any in-state examples of government services that pioneered an example?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative, that example that I shared, much of that first happened in our particular state with St. Paul Fire, an ambulance service that's a governmental ambulance service, City of St. Paul, and receives medical direction from R.J. Frasconi, Dr. Frasconi, who participated in much of that physician-led research that then was applied in the field.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Chair, I have a question for the author, too, if I may.
Representative Lesh, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, oftentimes I hear my colleagues saying that it's more important that government function more like a business. And can you give a reason why you think in this instance it's more important that a private business function more like government?
Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh. Again, it goes back to the heart of the bill. We've got a situation where these nonprofit businesses are held at different liability limits than government. I think we heard Mr. Reiner's testimony, and those additional pressures on those nonprofit organizations have contributed to their hesitancy to develop those innovations. And one, I think, could assert if those added pressures weren't there, that same innovation may have happened in those businesses, or may have even surpassed those in the government-run ones. We don't know.
Mr. Chair, one more question. Have you considered then, Representative Drazkowski, because I know there's a difference of opinion in this building and I'm sure on this committee about the proper roles of who does what, when, and where, whether it's a fire service or police service, whether it should be public or private or what have you. And I know that, as in most of the geographical area of the state, these medical services are provided by private providers. Have you considered, instead of just adding government protections to private businesses, just removing the government protections from government services? Had you considered that as an approach?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, I've thought about it, and I think we're all looking at going through this hearing and trying to figure out what the best approach is. The problem here is the difference between the two, as we heard in the testimony, and you've got a night and day approach where the government-run organizations are under a different set of rules than the nonprofits and hospital-based organizations. So. You have hit the nail on the head. It's the difference between the two that is the issue, I think that's what we're here for, is to hear some ideas around solutions.
To that issue, I don't know, Representative Drazkowski or Mr. Reinhardt, what's your thought, or maybe you don't have the right answer for this, but why is government capped in these instances? Either one of you have a thought on that, and I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that has an answer to that can testify later, but
Mr. Chair, it does
beg the question, why are we capping or protecting government and not small businesses?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reinert and I are looking at each other where we don't have the answer, but he has a kind of a corollary comment. I'm wondering if Mr. Gehring could maybe, any history that he might have, be able to bring us a little wisdom as well.
Mr. Gehring, you have any comment on that? And I don't mean to put you on the spot. If you don't have a brief history, that's fine, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me. I'm trying to say this carefully. The reason that government typically has caps on liability in statute is based on a policy choice that has been made constitutionally in the past, that if you expose government to unlimited liability, that it would prevent the ability of government to provide needed services to the public, because potentially if there was some sort of accident or some sort of injury that the government was liable for and they were exposed to $10 million or $50 million worth of liability, that cost would have to come from the state budget, and then it would result in government not being able to provide services that are needed because of needing to pay out the cost of the decision.
Sure.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski, and then Representative Gruenhagen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesher has a question, but Mr. Reinhart had another related comment, if he could share.
Mr. Reinhart, and then Representative Lesher has a follow-up, and then Representative Gruenhagen.
Mr. Chair, just based on the question about the ambulance services and being governmental versus non-governmental, one of the things that is unique about ambulance services is that we cover multiple governmental jurisdictions. So I can speak directly to my ambulance service, which covers 451 square miles. I have probably 13 cities, multiple townships, and also two additional counties. So if I was just, say, the city of North Branch ambulance service, you could imagine that then there would be 13 ambulance services in Chisago County alone, plus the additional ones in the two adjoining counties. We're able to provide service at a very efficient level by, instead of having multiple administration, education staff, all of those support services within all of those communities, we have one administration and then are able to cover that much broader area. So that may be a little bit of what the representative may have been asking.
To that issue, and then Representative Lesh, I'll get back to you. Is there other models out there that would be a joint powers board with, in your instance, I assume you're crossing county lines as well, where two or three counties might, instead of you being a nonprofit, create a joint powers board? And is that regulated, or are they affected differently with liability caps, i.e. are they under the government caps or not, if it's a structure different than that? Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware if there are joint power board examples in our particular state. There may be that I'm simply not aware of. Okay. The primary are hospital-based ambulance providers, non-for-profit ambulance providers. We have three for-profit ambulance providers in our state. And then the remaining roughly rough numbers are than governmentals.
Okay. Representative Lesh, follow up.
I just wanted to address the issue about the official immunity, Mr. Chair, never passing up the opportunity to be a nerd when I can. But that original idea, and I think related to your question, was the official immunity is the idea behind that the government is the sovereign. And originally, under English common law, the sovereign owned everything and only parceled it out under the feudal system to people as he saw fit, thereby you couldn't sue someone for something that was already his because he was the king. As we translated to the new world, the English common law system to a constitutional system, the sovereign was the government, which were all three branches. We did allow, as Mr. Gehrig described, the limited liability function, which was newly introduced. But people saw the effects of that when related to when the bridge went down. We had to appropriate a special appropriation for that because government was limited. And I believe the limits for the governmental ambulance services are under that same section of statute, unless I'm wrong, Mr. Gehrig. So it is the same official immunity limited liability that we saw for government for the bridge collapse or for what would be under ambulance services. That's my nerd moment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good, Representative Lesh. Scholarly. Representative Gruenhagen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Reinhart, thank you for your service to your community, and I did need an ambulance ride one time, so I appreciated the EMTs that helped me. You know, if I understand your testimony correctly, currently you have unlimited liability. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay. Can I just make
Gruenhagen, go ahead.
A couple of follow-up questions here? Secondly, the government has limited. So, you know, from my perspective, you know, you're being discriminated against, okay? And earlier today I heard testimony from the Human Rights Department. You may want to file a complaint, okay? But, Mr. Chair, just a couple follow-up comments. To me, I think one of the principles legally is that everyone's treated equally. To me, you should be given an equal opportunity compared to a government entity, at least as far as liability cost. You also indicated that there's fewer and fewer writers of that type of liability. Is that correct, Mr. Reiner?
Mr. Reiner.
Representative, yes.
So my next question is, if you go out of business, it's probably a government entity that would take the ambulance service over. Is that correct?
Mr. Reiner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, possibly. However, I would suggest to the committee that the more likely solution, the more likely scenario would be that there would be no ambulance provider. The community, for example, one of the communities I serve, North Branch, this week is debating if it can continue to have its police department based on its cuts that it needs to make. It may not be able to provide law enforcement anymore. It may need to find another solution. If Lakes Region EMS longer was able to provide service, I'm not sure if there would be anyone who would provide service. That area may go unserved in our state. And there is no legal obligation of any unit of government in the state of Minnesota to ensure provision of ambulance services.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
So basically, the threat of lawsuits and actual lawsuits has the potential to endanger the health of the public by eliminating a service that is desperately needed in case of emergency situation. Would you agree with that comment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, another follow-up question is, one observation and comment is, when I look at this situation, we're basically at a point where, from a discriminatory and public health standpoint or public safety standpoint, it behooves us as responsible elected officials to create an equal playing field for a private business to stay in business and serve the public safety rather than be forced into a situation due to the threat of lawsuits of going out of business and actually endangering the public safety. Representative Drazkowski, would you concur with that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gruenhagen, yes. I mean, that's what we're looking at. We want to make certain. I know in my district in southeast Minnesota, we have other ambulance services that have expressed the same thing. Their operational costs are getting to be so high that they're not certain whether they're going to be able to be in business anymore. And certainly, as we heard in the testimony, the insurance, the liability, contributes significantly to that.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up comment.
Representative Grunhagen.
As I look at this, I think that we need some type of limits in place. I'm not sure whether the governments should be increased some and then the private sector equalized with that. But to me, we want to treat them equally, and we for sure don't want to create a situation where lawsuits or the threat of lawsuits endanger our public safety. That's just an observation. So my initial thought is I'd be strongly supportive of this bill, although I can see where the amount of limits as far as individuals or the situation is concerned might be a point of discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski, and just a bit of information before. Council told me joint powers boards, Mr. Reinhart and Representative Drazkowski in committee, would be covered under government liability caps if counties got together and operated. They would be covered under liability caps.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr.
Comment, and then I'd like to get to the other testifiers.
Yes, I would just like to comment. That is, it was brought up earlier, the situation with the 35W collapse. And again, just to reiterate, in Chapter 144E, these private ambulance operations are required, they're compelled by law to respond via mutual aid in these situations. And as I understand it, in that particular situation, there was a large number, I don't know how many different ambulance services, maybe dozens, that responded. And I don't know exactly how their liability played out in that whole thing when the government representative did come in and provide some additional large amount of support for those victims of that particular tragedy. But certainly that's an example of where You've got both types of ambulance services on the same call with two different set of circumstances that dictate their liability.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. We do have some other witnesses. Mr. Reinhart, thank you for your comment. If you can stick around, if there's further questions, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Joe Carlson, do you want to come forward? And I understand you might have a testifier or two as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson here for the Association for Justice. I've been waiting for my cell phone to buzz to find out if Amy Blatz is going to be able to be here. We scheduled her to testify, although I haven't heard from her yet, and so I apologize for her absence. I have with me Mark Streed, who is a lawyer in private practice at Meshbesher & Spence. I want him to talk a little bit about the bill, and then I have some information I gave to the committee that I'd like to go through.
Very good. Mr. Streed, if you want to identify yourself for the record, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. I'm Mark Streed. I am, as Joel said, a private lawyer at Meshbesher & Spence, also a member and a part of the executive committee at Minnesota Association for Justice. I just have a couple of points to make. One is when you look at a piece of legislation like this, and many good questions have been asked, and it seems like the committee has a very good grasp of the issues, you have to ask what is the problem or issue that is attempted to be addressed here, and whose rights are being expanded, and then most importantly, whose rights are being affected on the flip side, restricted or taken away. And on that point, I've been asked to talk about a case. It's a very sad case. It's a very real case. It involved Mary Blatz, the daughter of a longtime representative of these chambers, Jerome Blatz, the sister of our former Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz. And Mary Blatz, her daughter Amy was going to be here today. I've been asked to tell you about that and how it ties into this proposed legislation. And that is, Mary Blatz in the 90s was a very vibrant, active mother of two young children. She was a breadwinner. She worked for Northwest Airlines. She had a husband who was a veteran of the armed forces, and one day, unfortunately, she had a problem, a medical problem, and ultimately a privately run business ambulance crew came, and mistakes were made. I won't get into all of that, but ultimately she suffered irreversible brain damage that affected her for the rest of her life. She was hospitalized for many, many weeks, many, many months, intermediate care facility. Fortunately, she was able to come home on the weekends. It was a very, very sad case, and unfortunately, it took many years to go through the court system. Ultimately, a jury, not lawyers, but a jury decided that the complete problem that she suffered was caused by the ambulance crew, and it was a privately run, privately owned ambulance company. But along the way, the state of Minnesota and its taxpayers supported the medical bills, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, by the time the case finally was done with on appeal. And you can look it up. It's up at the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. It took many years. And in the end, Mary Blatz and her family were able to get her back home. The state of Minnesota was paid back out of that verdict. For all of the benefits that were paid over the course of time to support her. She was instilled with the dignity and allowed to live the rest of her life in her home with private care. And that's an example of a situation where, and I meant to state at the start, Mr. Reinhart and all of the emergency medical technicians that serve our state, they do an incredible job that we are all very appreciative of. Many of our family members have probably had, and some of us have needed their services. Once in a while, mistakes are made. And privately run, privately owned businesses all have a responsibility. Personal responsibility is a two-way street. And when mistakes are made, that's why we carry insurance. That's why private ambulance services like Alina, Mr. Reinert's company. Part of the cost of doing business when you're a privately run business is to make sure you buy the type of insurance that protects you and your company and your consumers if they're victimized by your mistakes. And we're all human. We all make mistakes. Doesn't mean you're a bad person or you're a bad company. But if this cap was instilled, and it's really unprecedented that a municipality or caps that protect municipalities for completely different reasons than private businesses, if that was unprecedentedly shifted over to protect privately run businesses, it flies in the face of what we all look for when you run a business, and that is responsibility. I don't have anything else. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, representatives.
Mr. Streed, on that point, I appreciate your testimony. Why do you think a government-run ambulance should be held to a different standard or have a different threat of liability than a private-run business?
Mr. Chair, thank you. They're really held to the same standard of care. They've got the same duties. They've got to act reasonably. They're very heavy and hard duties to prove when there are mistakes, because there are lots of decisions that have to be made that EMS crews do and almost always do well. So the standards of care are the same. The difference, I think, that you're referring to is that why is there a difference in a governmental ambulance crew being held to a certain cap of $500,000 or $1.5 for multiple incidents versus a privately run business? And it goes to what Mr. Gehring had talked about and Representative Lesch, and that goes to, you know, there's protections, there's budgetary issues that have to be set for whether it's a state, a city, or a county. The exposures, if there were verdicts or settlements that exceeded those budgets, it would come back to the taxpayers to have to pay, to fund and pay, and there needs to be some fixation or fixed amounts for the protection of the municipalities. It's different than private business.
Follow up on that. I mean, inherent in that, though, isn't the incentive then to tend or trend towards the government running the system rather than a private small business?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. I believe that there are privately run businesses in the state of Minnesota that do the vast majority of the ambulance runs, or over 50,000, one in particular, I believe, a Alina system, and they're all over the state, both urban and rural, and they do annually around 50,000 ambulance runs with their EMS technicians. So I think there's a large amount of private competition to take over or run ambulance. It's a business that apparently is doing well when it's run well.
Thank you. Representative Scott. Then Representative Lesch and Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, appreciate you being here. That's a tragic story. My question, though, is that what if it would have been a government-run ambulance that would have showed up that day? And how would your client then have been indemnified, you know, with the limits that the government services currently have on them?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Street.
That's a good question, and I probably didn't explain it very, very well. The sad fact is catastrophically injured people like Mary Blatz, that have to, whose family can't take care of them on a full-time basis, end up at one of our long-term care facilities. And this was a middle-class family. They could not afford it. She became eligible and was covered by the state of Minnesota. and the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and eventually, if it had not been for this verdict against Allina and their insurance company, it would have been the state of Minnesota that would have paid the millions of dollars that would have continued to be needed to provide her with the care for the rest of her life. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, the fact that this privately run business was responsible enough to have liability insurance in place that ultimately afforded coverage to Mary Blatz and her family. All those hundreds of thousands of dollars that the state had already expended to care for her ultimately got paid back out of that verdict, that payment from the Allina insurance company. The state got brought back to par, essentially, for what they had paid. So if it hadn't been, there had not been the insurance that covered the private business that made the mistake here in the ambulance run, it would have ultimately been the state of Minnesota that would have continued to pay all of that. So that would have been the difference.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And just one comment that I wanted to address with you, Mr. Street. You said that the government has budgetary issues, and I just wanted to point out that businesses do as well. And, you know, higher liability insurance and stuff is one of those budgetary issues that they may have. And just wanted to bring that to your attention. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out, as we talk about liability caps here, who we're talking about now as a consumer or a prospective consumer of ambulance services. You know, I know that if it's a government service that picks me up, there's certain liability caps that if something happens to me, like happened to Ms. Blatz, there are certain caps. But I'm assuming there are caps as well for insurance policies. I mean, insurance policies have caps. So what we're talking about here is, from the perspective of a consumer, are we talking about a private cap or a public cap? What can you tell me? Is there a standard cap that insurance companies give? If I'm a rural service, say I can afford a certain limited type of coverage based on the services I provide, how are those caps different from suburban service that maybe has a broader service base? What are we talking about for private caps for insurance companies as they stand now?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Street?
Representative Lesh, you're getting a little outside of my area of expertise as far as the insurance underwriting and limits. I believe there are incremental limits on EMS crews, privately run ambulances, in the $5 to $10 to $15 million. Sometimes there's a first layer of X dollars with an umbrella excess coverage that's fortunately less expensive, because rarely, thankfully, do catastrophic injuries like this happen. But when they do happen, it has a devastating effect not only on the family and the victim, but also potentially the state and the taxpayers. And that's why it's the really bad, serious incidents like this that, like I've said, they don't happen that much because the work is usually so well done. But when it does happen, I guess I'm not really answering your question because I don't know exactly what those limits are typically, but they're usually at least in the $5 to $10 million range.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I asked is because I'm trying to figure out what recourse I would have. Say something tragic happened to my daughter, and I couldn't afford to take care of her. What happens to me? I know that if it's a public service, for example, public ambulance service, you know, and there are certain caps, there are other recourses. We have a claims commission up here, just much like when the 35W bridge went down. We set up a separate process even outside of the claims commission to deal with that and take care of that. But that's just the point of my question. I see those recourses with public services, and I don't know what the recourse would be for a private service other than the litigation, which I think generally keeps people honest. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Representative Mahoney.
Actually, my question's been answered.
Okay, Representative, somebody else had a question. Peterson, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that you stated that the standard of care and the training and licenses were the same for public and private.
Mr. Street.
For those services and for the employees who are with those services.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is this, you know, as a lawyer, if I'm representing a consumer who has been damaged or injured because of negligence, failure to act reasonably by an ambulance crew, the standards are the same. Standard of care are the same, whether it be a municipal owned and run ambulance service or a privately owned and run ambulance services. They've got the same duties and obligations and standards. Yeah.
Any other questions, members? Mr. Street, I got a question on the caps of government units. Should they be raised at all? Is $500,000 high enough in a government entity? Any comments on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, they aren't even close to being enough for the catastrophic type situations that occasionally occur in our society. The bridge case is perhaps exhibit A to that, but fortunately, this body recognized that and passed legislation to address that very unique situation. But unfortunately, there are also other situations that don't get into the news that involve municipalities, and the caps aren't adequate to come close to addressing those types of situations. And when that happens, the state ultimately ends up on the hook, so to speak. Anyway, there are solutions that could be adopted, increasing the caps, providing other sources of insurance coverage for the municipalities. And frankly, some municipalities do carry their own insurance on top of that to provide extra protection to consumers or victims of the occasional negligent act that happens.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Representative Peterson. I think the handout that the ambulance service provided you answered your question very well in the second paragraph. It says that all ambulance services and personnel who work on them are regulated by the provisions of Chapter 144E, and that the law is blind as to ownership. It doesn't matter whether it's private or public. They're all regulated the same. And it's a document that I actually wanted to talk a little bit about, because on the second page on paragraph 9, it talks about the Department of Commerce study, Mr. Chair and members, about one of the most effective ways to lower the cost of insurance. And the most effective way to lower the cost of insurance premiums is to lower either the frequency or the average cost of the claim. I gave some information to the committee. Need you to know that medical malpractice claims in Minnesota, and that's what we're talking about here, in 2010, according to the Minnesota Supreme Court, were 110 cases statewide. 110. That is the entire field of medical malpractice cases. And I point that out because as we look at this bill, I would submit to you with so few cases, and it happens so infrequently, that this bill would have no or at best minimal impact on the insurance that these companies paid. We've had this bill before the legislature on several occasions, and the testimony has always been twofold. One, there have been very few claims filed against the ambulance services. And that, two, unless you adopt the immunities in all parts of Chapter 466 that protect governmental entities, this bill would have no impact on the insurance rates that they pay. And if you look at the handout that I gave you, Mr. Chair and members, Minnesota has the lowest medical malpractice premiums in the country. and that is not something we invented. That's from the Medical Liability Monitor, the most respected journal relative to medical insurance in the country. We have the lowest rates in the country, and I think it's because of the quality of care that we have and the good work that these physicians and EMT providers give us. We have an excellent system for screening out cases that don't have merit, and we have the single largest doctor-owned insurance trust company that insures many medical providers in the state. That's why we have low insurance premiums in Minnesota. To contrast that, what this bill does is says to those private companies that we are going to allow you, when you do have a claim, to shift the cost of that claim, not from your insurance carrier, but to the taxpayer when those claims exceed $500,000, a hard cap of $500,000. I gave you the 2009 annual report for Allina Hospitals. And you'll note in there that they have 24,000 employees, annual revenue of $3.2 billion, and they made over 50,000 ambulance runs. 50,000 just for one company alone. When you compare those 50,000 runs to the entire field of malpractice cases being 101 in the entire state, you can see that this bill wouldn't have any significant impact on the rates that they charge. If it does, we should mandate that reduction in this bill. If it is going to benefit them, we should put it in here. I don't believe that it will, and the testimony has always been that it will not. Mr. Chair and members, you know, it is rare when we need to seek redress in our court for injuries that exceed $500,000. But the law and the Constitution provides us a recovery, a complete recovery, when we are injured through someone else's negligent conduct. And I think that it is unfair to those rare victims like Mary Blatz, who testified with me, by the way, against this bill, cap on damages, several years ago. She has since passed away. But I think it's patently unfair to shift those costs from those families onto those families and away from private entities and then ultimately to the taxpayers, because that's, I think, what the real crux of the problem is. And I wish Amy Blatz would be here to tell you what their family went through her injury and her rehabilitation and her ultimate death. But to suggest that the fairness goes to the person who committed the wrong and that the Blatz family and the taxpayers should pick up those costs, I think, is unfair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for either testifier. I guess one of my concerns with this bill is where it might end. And I think too often around here we talk about slippery slopes, which isn't always the case, but I think it's important to at least ask about it here. So if an ambulance provider can cloak itself in the government's lower liability limits, what logical end is there to any other private entity contracting with the government to say, we too, in case we're negligent, in case we cause someone grave injury or harm or, you know, lifelong debilitation, what other entities could also cloak themselves in the same liability projection? Could it be the Starbucks in the courthouse? Could it be anyone who contracts with the government?
Yeah. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Street.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that's a good question, and what I think is it could start the snowball, and it could go on and start other entities may well be here seeking similar protections. But it flies in the face of the whole concept that we all believe, or most of us believe in, I think maybe even everybody, and that is personal responsibility. And personal responsibility is a two-way street. And that means when you make a mistake as a private business or a private business person, you own up to it. And don't hide behind a cap. You take out the appropriate insurance. You factor that into your cost of doing business. I'm well aware of the fact that that is part of doing business because I pay it. And that's an important aspect of our economy and our whole system, and that is personal responsibility and doing the right thing.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, and Mr. Street, you can't have known this because you weren't in this committee, but that's been an ongoing theme in this committee is personal responsibility, and I think that's a good discussion to have here. I think Mr. Carlson pointed out here in one of the handouts that we all have, medical malpractice claims, but as you can see from the handout, in recent years, because there's been some debate about whether we're a sue-happy society, either generally or in Minnesota, and what this data from the Supreme Court shows, as you know, personal injury cases down, wrongful death cases down, malpractice actions down, harassment cases down, employment cases down. You know what is up? Business litigation cases. And I can feel free to say that because that's what I do for a living. But businesses suing other businesses, as in contract disputes, that's up. That's who's using the court system. But I think around here there's far too little objection to that. Not that I think there should be. I think anyone who has a claim in our society should have access to justice, be that an individual or a business. If a business has suffered an injustice, they have a right, whether it's a contract claim or anything else, to go and use our courts. That's what they're for. So I'm not dissuading that. But sometimes around here, there's an awful lot of attention paid to the little guy who's trying to get justice. But if it's a business using the court system to go after another business, bigger or smaller, there just isn't that same level of care around here. So business litigation sure is up, but the other individual claims, personal injury, medical malpractice, wrongful death, harassment, employment, those are all down in recent years. Not up, but down. And I think that's worth noting. I think the other thing worth noting is, what does it really mean, and you're the expert here, Mr. Street, but if you're found negligent by a jury, it's not just a mistake. I mean, you can make a mistake without being negligent. Everyone makes mistakes. I do often. You do. We all do. But to be liable here, you need to, I mean, the basic prongs are, you need to have a duty that's recognized in law. You need to have breached that duty, and you need to have inflicted harm on someone. And that's a tough standard to prove. So it's not just a question of someone suddenly be dinged for millions of dollars because of a mistake, or just kind of a human error. It's beyond that. It's someone who, through their own actions, not intentionally, not because they wish someone harm, but someone who breached a duty that they have, in this case, a duty of reasonable care. And that's then and only then are they on the hook for any money. I think it sort of gets back to what you said. It's about personal responsibility. If you break it, you fix it. And you don't hide behind the government. And if you break a person, you fix the person too. And I don't know why we would depart from that rule. I'm very sympathetic and grateful to the work that Mr. Reiner and other people do in this area. But I think that anyone, Mr. Reiner or anyone else, if they break something through the fault of their own negligence, I think that it's fair for the victim of that negligence to at least have a shot here at a full recovery. Otherwise, as you pointed out, it's the rest of us as taxpayers who are often on the hook. It's just a shift away from the insurance companies who would normally pay to all of us. So it's just kind of shifting the burden. That's obviously more of a comment, but if you'd like to comment, that's fine.
And Mr. Street, any comment? Or Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, in the interest of brevity, I agree with what you say, that it's right. Yeah, that is exactly right. It is a heavy burden. Mr. Carlson cited the relatively modest number of malpractice cases that are brought into our courts, and of those number, we don't have that, but very small number of that would be related to EMS negligence, and it is a heavy burden. Of those cases that go to court, there's a certain amount that aren't proven and are dismissed in favor of the defense. So it is a system that works, and it needs to recognize those catastrophic situations that happen, that those people deserve the dignity, like Mary Blatz. She deserves the dignity of living her rest of her days with good, top-notch care so that she can get as much of what was taken back from out of her that she'll never get back, and at least have that dignity and ability to live that way. And that's why private businesses carry insurance with large limits for those kind of situations.
And Mr. Chairman, let me just,
Mr. Carlson,
let me just conclude by telling you that on behalf of our association, we absolutely understand the vital role that ambulance services provide, and we actually work with them because although they said their largest payer was Medicaid, which is about 38%, the balance of their reimbursements come from private individuals through auto insurance, through accidents. It is those kinds of runs that actually allow them to stay in business. You know, if they were operating just on Medicaid reimbursement at 60 cents on the dollar, they'd be out of business. They do a run for an automobile accident, they're able to bill your insurer for the actual cost of what that run entails. And we're committed to helping them continue that. There are some people that want to lower those rates that they would be able to charge for the actual cost of their service. We're absolutely committed to that. We just think that this bill, with the few cases that are out there, would not save any would not save them anything in insurance. And these are businesses, as you know, as they provided to you, don't compete. They get a dedicated service area. There's not competition among ambulance services. They don't compete. And we're committed to helping them in this non-competitive marketplace reduce their costs because competition is not going to do it. We're committed to help them do that. But we think this is just a wrong way beyond a slippery slope. We think it takes away our constitutional right to a redress. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I don't think we have any further questions for either of you. I appreciate you coming. Do you have anybody else plan to testify?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time, and apologize for the absence of a witness. And if you do bring the bill back up at another time, we'll see if they're able to attend at that time.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen, you got a question, and then I got a question for Mr. Reinhart and Representative Skowski.
And Mr.
Final
Chair,
comments.
To the testifiers, but what strikes me as slightly unjust is that if we have a severe situation, and I empathize with the people that are in that or have that happen to them, as far as I know, it could happen to me or one of my family members. I understand that, and I've sold health insurance for 30 years, and I've seen a lot of very terrible accidents and bad health situations. But if we, that incident happens, we send the ambulance out. If it's a government ambulance, we're willing to accept all the arguments for lower liability costs, okay? But if it's a private business, we're willing to accept none of those arguments for lower liability costs. That is a clear case of, in my mind, of discriminating against private business to the exclusion of government. And whether it lowers their cost or not, just as a matter of equality under the law, it just strikes me, and I'm not a lawyer, so maybe I'm not enlightened enough, that's an unjust way of treating private business and giving government benefits and exceptions that don't apply to the private sector. And, believing in the Constitution and the principles our country is founded on, that just strikes me as unjust. Finally, I would say maybe we need to adjust the limits with the government side, okay? But let's keep it equal for the private and the public sector. Would you please respond to those comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, maybe this is a good chance to get back to the question you put to committee staff. In 1963, when the Minnesota Supreme Court said we are no longer going to allow sovereign immunity to exist, that is unfair. We are not going to let the government get away with its torts without paying compensation. And we are going to tell the legislature that you are going to come up with a law that does two things. It makes government responsible for its actions, but it also protects the taxpayers. And what is unjust, we accept the idea that caps on governmental liability, although they may be too low, protect all of us. Because when those costs are not paid, the taxpayer is going to pay anyway. That's why we have a cap, because we don't want to transfer huge costs to the taxpayers through the tort system. What this bill says is that we're going to take the private industry and take their damages and now transfer those to the taxpayers. And that is what I think is unjust. To get to that point, you have to accept that the reason for the cap is to protect all of us when there are catastrophic losses as government. That is not the case. It has never been the case for private companies in Minnesota. We do not want to shift the liability for their wrongful conduct to taxpayers. And I contend that's what this bill does with a $500,000 hard cap.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up?
Representative Grunhagen.
You know, the same argument, I believe, can be made, though, when we discriminate in terms of the private sector and to the degree that that puts them out of business, you ultimately endanger the public safety of the very citizens that you're trying to protect as taxpayers by reducing those services that are necessary in an emergency situation. And based on the testimony we have, if this service goes out of business, he is not sure either the government or anybody else would replace them. So when we have this type of a tort system in place that penalizes private business to the tune of going out of business and endangering the public health of the very citizens we're trying to protect on the taxpayer side, I think we have to have a balance there. I appreciate a response to those comments.
Mr. Carlson, Mr. Street.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, that's just not happening. That's the problem. The perception that the cost of this insurance is going to put someone out of business, that perception is not reality. It is not reality. That is not happening.
Mr. Chair, it's the reality that the testifier before you by Mr. Reinhart seemed to believe in his from his point of view.
He said, Mr. Chairman, I think that mischaracterizes his testimony. What he said is he's seen increases in his insurance, as we all have. And when medical costs go up 30% and 40% per year, and what you're purchasing insurance for is to pay ongoing medical care for someone who's injured by your negligence, those costs are going to go up. That's just driven by medical inflation. That's not even driven by lawsuits. Most of them will come here and tell you they've never had a claim. That is, that cost of that insurance going up is driven because what they have to indemnify against is paying medical benefits. That's why it goes up. It has nothing to do with litigation. I don't want to say that. I'm not saying that risk doesn't have some factor in insurance rates. I don't want to go quite that far.
Amen.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Street.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, two questions, and I think one is I understand the struggle of business with insurance premiums, but with the limited amount of claims that are being brought in our state, I wonder about why there are those increase in premiums. Perhaps the question should be addressed to a different entity right now. But secondly, if a small business can't make it, entities like Allina that are growing and growing and growing, up to 50,000 ambulance runs, urban, becoming more rural, there's others like Allina, there's going to be, the competition is there. It's going to be, if someone that's smaller can't make it, another entity is going to be in there, whether it be private, is going to be in there, whether it be private or large. But the fairness question that you asked is it fair for private EMS businesses versus a municipality? And I'll just ask or point out that what if it's one of our loved ones and they have this catastrophic thing happen and they're being handled by a county or a municipality, and the same thing happens that happened to Mary Blatz or others? Is that fair? Is it fair for them to only have the ability to accept what the state-funded long-term care facility? Is it fair for them not to be able to have the resources to put an addition on their house so that they can have private care and live and have the dignity that a private insurance company settlement or verdict would provide, and instead be stuck with what the state funding would provide them? It wouldn't be fair to them, and it wouldn't be fair to our taxpayers if that were to happen.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you for that response, Mr. Street. But I didn't use the word fairness. I used the word justice. Justice is based on principles. Fairness is based on feelings, from my perspective. Okay, I'm more interested in principles rather than feelings. But back to the previous statement, Mr. Reinhart, would you clarify? Evidently, there's some misperception between myself and the testifiers on the need to put some limits on liability, or Representative Drazkowski. Would you care to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And I don't believe we have any other questions for either of you. I appreciate you coming. Mr. Reinhart, follow-up question, and then Representative Drazkowski will let you make some final comments.
Mr. Chair, Representative, could you restate the question again?
Well, there seemed, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
There seemed to be some confusion over the fact that the lawsuit risk or the actual settlements, the risk of lawsuit or the actual settlement, had any effect on your liability insurance, which by conclusion would also affect the number of carriers, which we see is decreasing because we have an unlimited liability there, and obviously actuaries figured both the risk and the actual lawsuits into what their premiums are, and carriers do too, and when that becomes too variable and unpredictable, you have carriers pull out of the market. So if you would speak to the fact that it does affect, that you believe it does affect your cost of business and ultimately your ability to stay in business.
Mr. Reinhart, I think he's referring to the comment you made that you've seen your costs go up about 15% and on top of normal increases.
Right.
Is that what you're referring to, Representative Grunhagen, as I recall?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely. And I think a word that was used that probably better articulated what I was trying to explain is risk. The risk of litigation is immense based on the things that we do and the environment that we do them in. We don't have the ability to do them within a nicely lit room that's climate controlled. We can't tap into specialists. We do them in all of the places that you can imagine that we do them in. When St. Paul Companies left the market of providing coverage to ambulance services, they were very clear to articulate it was due to the risk, that it was a risk that they no longer felt comfortable being able to provide. I'm not in a position, I don't sell insurance, so I'm not able to articulate if it was because of maybe the smaller number that has been discussed here today, but the size of the judgments, again, I can only speak to the committee about what I can tell you with 100% surety and with all sincerity, but when we look every year to find insurance for our medical malpractice and general liability, there are, in our particular case, two choices. And because of those two choices, there's not a lot of competition to be able to either maintain the premiums or drive the premiums down.
So, Mr. Reinhart, any idea or inclination from St. Paul Companies or other insurers that they may re-enter the market if a bill like this or something similar would pass?
Mr. Chairman, I would only be guessing there. I couldn't honestly say. What I can do is speak more indirectly to that question in my conversation with our current insurance provider about this very issue and what impact it would have on our insurance premiums. And again, without knowing the right language that insurance providers use, what they spoke to was risk. Mm-hmm. Being able to reduce or hold the potential claims to a set amount has a direct impact on what our premiums are going to be. I did want to mention, with the chair's permission, just a little bit on the 35W bridge collapse that has been mentioned a few times. My ambulance service responded to the 35W bridge collapse, not because it's in our area, not because it's anywhere near Chisago County, because we were the last to actually clear the bridge. Our ambulance service was coming back from delivering a patient to the Metro, cleared the bridge shortly before it collapsed. All ambulance providers that day that responded, except for one, Hennepin County Ambulance Service, were non-governmentals. So we go knowing that we're getting ourselves into all kinds of situations with a risk that at some point in time we may have to ask if we can do. So I wanted to make just one last comment. If non-governmental ambulance services go away and somebody provides the service, if it gets provided at all, it would probably be governmental. Hence, this issue becomes moot because then the TORC caps are in place.
Question on the TORC cap or on your liability. Typically, what do you insure? Is your insurance capped at a certain, your liability capped at a certain amount right now? Oftentimes, you buy a policy and it's capped at $10 million or some other number. Do you typically, is there a level that the ambulance services buy?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Generally, the coverage is a $1 million, $3 million medical malpractice liability, and then have, as was mentioned by the previous testifiers, have an umbrella coverage, which I believe is somewhere between $10 and $15 million. I'm not sure of that exact maximum amount. But the general coverage is $1 million, $3 million, and then with an umbrella.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Drazkowski, any final comments, and then we'll lay this bill on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think we had a good discussion. We've certainly covered an issue here that the disparity between these two is one I know that I've heard ambulance providers in my part of the state talking about over the last several years. This particular bill or approach, as was mentioned in earlier testimony, has been brought before the legislature in the past. It received bipartisan support at that time, and so it's not a one party or the other. But the most important thing here, I think, is that it would, if we can move in this direction, will help rural ambulances reduce those costs so they can better serve at their clients and stay in business. And we heard in the testimony earlier they would also help provide better service for those areas that they do serve, provide for more opportunity to innovate and do the things that they would like to do. I was really intrigued by the discussion about, okay, if we did put these caps on the non-governmental side, in those extreme cases, which I understand there's only a handful, what would happen? And in the discussion was they would revert back to government, and government would cover those folks from there on out in one way or another. So, you know, the question goes, you know, it's a trade-off between the costs that we have for local ambulance providers and their ability to be viable in providing the services they provide, and how large of a share of the potential damages do we cover, which seems to be obvious. So, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing the bill. I will look forward to working with folks to maybe develop some approaches here that might work better for everyone.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Hilty has a question, and then we'll lay the bill over. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I see that Mr. Johnson is in the audience. Have you had any conversations with him or any representatives from the insurance industry that would suggest that if this bill passed, it would help Mr. Reinhart and others like him out in any way with the lowering of premiums?
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I haven't had direct discussion, but I received emails from insurance folks who didn't state that directly, but inherently in their communication, I think, were suggesting to me that it would be helpful at lowering the rates.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm certain that the insurance industry supports the bill, and I'm sure that it would have some result that they would find beneficial, but I'm not sure that that would devolve to Mr. Reinhart.
Representative Hilty and Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Representative Hilty, thank you for your sharing your thoughts. Thanks again, members, and look forward to developing a solution here.
Mr. Johnson, you probably heard those questions. If you have any thoughts, you can get them to our committee or Representative Druskowski on that those issues. I guess members to the audience, when or if we bring this back up, I don't necessarily intend to have a whole other hearing on it. We've had a thorough discussion on it, but I suspect maybe there will be some input from members. Whether there's modifications or amendments discussed would be possible discussions that would occur after this, and we would bring it back up for further discussion. But I wouldn't look for another hour or two of testimony and hearing or testimony on this matter. If we did bring it up, with that, the chair will lay this bill over. And thank you, Representative Druskowski. Members, we just got two sets of minutes to approve Representative Hortman. Would you give us a motion to approve them? And I understand you have an amendment.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move to accept the minutes of February 16th. And then I would move to, do you want two different motions?
Let's do the 16th first. That's not the one that you want to amend. Is there any discussion on the February 16th motion minutes? Representative Hortman moves to approve the minutes. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Hortman moves the approval of the 2:21 minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would move that they be amended so that it states that Representative Wardlow renewed his motion that 396 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register, that be moved under the sentence a quorum was present, because I know we moved the bill and the amendment when a quorum was present.
Correct. So you'd move the sentence up above? Or the
there twice.
Oh. Actually, Representative Hortman, we could just delete that first sentence because there's another sentence below that refers to the motion to renew the House file.
There's not. There's a sentence below a quorum that was present indicating we move the amendment, but before we can move the amendment, we have to move the bill. So I would move the sentence that says that we move the bill to state that happened after a quorum was present. It kind of happened before a quorum was present and after a quorum was present, so it could be in both places, but I think we should probably have it after a quorum was present.
The secretary have the modification. Members clear on what we're amending? We're moving the Wardlow renewal motion line after the quorum was present. Any further discussion? To Representative Hortman's move, motion to approve the 2:21 11 minutes as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman, and thank you, members. The meeting is adjourned.